May it please the court, and good morning. I'm Thomas Spoak, and with me at council table is Mark Schaefer, and we represent the appellant, which was one of the defendants below, Juno Loudon, LLC. Juno was the developer of a luxury golf course community in Loudon County, Virginia, called Creighton Farms, and the appellees and the plaintiffs below, the Nahigians, purchased a lot at Juno Farms in 2007. The only claim before this court on appeal is a claim under the Interstate Land Sales Full Disclosure Act for non-disclosure and rescission based on that. There is no claim for ILSA fraud and all state law.
What's your strongest argument that you win? What do you think your strongest argument is?
Sir, I think the strongest argument is the first one we raised, which is that the rescission claim is barred under 1703C and I'll refer to it. I know the courts can't even agree on what the right acronym is. I think the Fourth Circuit has ILSA, but I'll call it ILSA just because it's easier to say. But the under 1703C, in order to seek revocation for what's a non-disclosure violation, failure to give a property report, there's a two-year limit. And the two-year limit runs by the clear language of 15 U.S.C. 1703C from the date that the purchaser...
How does that subsection interact with the general damages provision of the Act?
Your Honor, I think a number of courts have struggled with that. And that's an important distinction, too, because there is a distinction between revocation and damages.
I'm not asking you what people, I'm asking you how you address it. What do you say? You claim there's a two-year statute of limitation for rescission, correct?
Yes, sir.
Well, I'm asking you to explain how we are to accept that. Maybe we should, in light of the general provision on action under this Act. That's what I'm asking. You explain it the way you think it needs to be explained.
Yes, sir. Under 15 U.S.C. 1703C, revocation must be sought within 2 years of the time you sign the purchase agreement. Under 15 U.S.C. 1711, which is the statute of limitations provision, you have to maintain suit within 3 years of signing the purchase agreement. Now, a number of courts have tried...
So you think the difference is 2 years and 3 years? That justifies us reading... See, the question is, why isn't there a other kind of rescission or rescission action allowed under the general provision? And you, because one says three and one says two, you think that's the answer?
Well, sir, it's not just me. I think there are about 15 district
courts. Well, I'm asking
courts.
You, though. I'm asking
yes, sir.
You. You think it rests because one says 3 years and one says two? That's the answer?
Yes, sir.
But do you want to elaborate on that,
sir? Yes, sir, because you have to read the two provisions together.
I'm asking you, how do we do that?
And the way you read them together is the way that I think the best example of this is the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Alabama and the Taylor versus Holiday Isle case, which has been followed by a number of district court cases since then, has said...
But hasn't the 11th Circuit, where Alabama sits, doesn't that case in Gentry in September go just the other way?
That may be, Your Honor. But there are still a number of cases that go in the direction that we do.
Going to Judge Shedd's point, 1709 talks about remedy, and it says such other, it identifies damages, and it identifies specific performance, and such other relief as the court deems fair, just, and equitable. Could Congress have given a broader statement of broad equitable relief in that language, the intent to give it the 3 years, the broadest equitable relief that could be envisioned to fulfill the purposes of the Act?
Your Honor, I think you have to read it in conjunction with 1703C.
I agree. And in Gentry, the case in September from the 11th Circuit, says automatic rescission occurs at 2 years without showing anything, and then common law rescission between 2 and 3 years requiring a demonstration of materiality. That's what it says, correct?
Yes, sir.
Why is that not compatible, that explanation compatible with the Act? And particularly the language of 1703C and 1709A.
Well, I think part of the problem, Your Honor, is if you read it in that way, as both the district court and as both the Higgins suggest, when you don't file a property report, who's to say what would have been in the property report? So you've essentially...
Well, that's a different issue. Judge Shedd's initial question was, what was your strongest argument? And you said 2 years on rescission.
Yes,
I'm
sir.
Glad to go to that issue next, but let's finish with the issue about whether it's 2 or 3 years.
Well, that's, I'm trying to tie that back to that, because if you took the position that Gentry is correct, then essentially you read 1703C out of the...
No, you read it for automatic. You don't have to show anything. You don't have to show materiality. 2 years, boom, you get to rescind. But after 2 years, into 3 years, you've got to meet the common law burden, which additionally requires a demonstration of materiality, correct?
Well, that's...
That's what the Gentry court said.
That's certainly what Gentry said, and that's certainly what Plant said. However...
And the court below said.
However, I would submit that that's unworkable and undercuts 1703C because if you don't have a property report, then essentially it's like saying it's per se 3 years.
No, it's got to be material. And in this case, there was a demonstration that the representation that what would have been in there would have demonstrated that Rich Carlton really did not own the place, had very little skin in the game, and that the developer had very little assets. That all would have been demonstrated in the report, and the court reasonably concluded on that it would have been material.
Well, I would disagree with some of the conclusions Your Honor has
reached
on summary
said.
Judgment. This is a decision that was done on summary judgment and is entitled to de novo review, so I don't think that was all.
But that's what the district court
found. The district court found based on summary judgment, which is entitled to de novo review. But I would point out the word rescission does not appear in ILSA. The word revoke does. If you look in the dictionary, revoke and rescission mean the same thing. So essentially, as a matter of statutory interpretation and statutory language, 1703 gives Congress's, when Congress has said that you're entitled
it may,
to rescission.
That's true. Nobody's arguing that point. Maybe you're arguing with yourself. That doesn't address the question Judge Gergel asked you.
Well,
he sees it as rescission. He sees rescission under 1703C as automatic. No proof of materiality need to be shown.
Yes, sir.
But he's asking, why can't those two provisions be read consistently, that there's a lesser showing required under C than there is under the general provision on suits? And your answer is?
Well, first, Your Honor, I would note 1703C doesn't have the word automatic in it.
It doesn't.
Right.
You're correct.
So that's a judicial construct to try to make this distinction between equitable rescission, the word rescission not appearing in ILSA either, nor does the word automatic appear.
So then do you think what does may be revoked in 1703C mean to you? May be revoked at the option of the purchaser.
May be revoked.
Does that require any showing, do you think?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Does that require any showing of materiality?
No, Your Honor. I think what it requires is that
does it require a showing of materiality?
No, Your Honor. Not within the 2 year period.
So, but it would require a showing of materiality after the 2 year period.
I don't think there is any after the 2 year period.
Common law rescission requires a showing of materiality.
Yes, that's right, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. So, if you are in graft. If you are to say that it's consistent with 1703C, even though rescission doesn't appear anywhere in ILSA, revocation does. Revocation means rescission, and the only rescission that is specifically specified in ILSA is under 1703C.
Well, 1709 refers to relief that is equitable, and there is no question that part of equitable relief is rescission, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
The term equitable in 1709 is very broad, is it not?
It is, Your Honor, although, once again, I would submit that 1703C is a limitation on that, and that you have to read the two together, as a number of courts have suggested. I'll also address, if I may, the exemption from ILSA disclosure requirements under 72.
Why do you think you're entitled to that exemption?
Because, Your Honor, under the HUD interpretive rule, which was first published in the Federal Register in 1983 and in effect since then, sales to builders may be either past or future sales. Okay, and that's consistent with the Dictionary Act, which applies to all interpretations of the United States Code. And the Dictionary Act says the words used in the present tense include the future as well as the present. The Dictionary Act was in effect when ILSA was enacted. Obviously, the people charged with the administration of the statute at the Housing and Urban Development, HUD, wrote this interpretive rule
with the Dictionary Act. Is there any dispute in the record that the plan for this development is to sell less than 100 units to residential purchasers or people who count under the Act? Is there any dispute about that?
Well, I think maybe the other side would maintain there's a dispute. I don't think there's any material dispute. We introduced an affidavit from Mr. Alpert. We also had an opinion letter from 2005. We also had a deposition of Mr. Ira Fenton, who was the original developer, all saying that the intent all along was to hold back at least half of the lots, which would have been some 82 lots, which would put you well under 100.
Didn't Mr. Nahegan testify that he was offered any one of the 164 that were available?
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's where he would claim there's a dispute. However, what you have to do is you have to look at the HUD interpretive rule, and that says reserved lots need not be specifically identified.
But you can't be offering them to someone. The question is, there a common promotional plan, and there's a presumption in the statute if you offer them collectively, there's a common promotional plan, correct?
Well,
that's what the statute says.
Well, I would disagree that the common promotional plan applies to the exemption for sales to builder. The common promotional plan, and that's where I would disagree with Judge Gutierrez's first opinion, too. Common promotional plan is, okay, it does also apply. Then you have the exemptions under 1702A and 1702B that apply if there is a common promotional plan. So there I would disagree with the way Your Honor has posited it, is if there is a common promotional plan, then you see, well, are you within the exemption?
164 lots to offering 164 lots to a prospective purchaser, and then you want to come here and tell us it's 82 were reserved for builders. That wasn't the way it was pitched to Mr. Nahegan, was it?
Sir, it wasn't pitched in terms of whether any lots were reserved to builders or not. It was just these are the lots that are
available. And he could have bought any one of those 164, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is your argument that it's not an inconsistency because he could have picked anyone, but it's not inconsistent because everything from your side is that once you got to 82 sales of residential qualifying, the sales would stop?
That's correct, Your Honor, that there were a fixed number of lots from the get-go before any marketing began.
You say fixed number, but not specific lots.
That's correct, and that's consistent with the HUD rules because they specifically say the reserved lots need not be specifically identified. And that's, if you look at page 17 of the text of our opening brief, which is, I think, page 24 in the electronic docketed version, you'll see that precise language. I'm getting close to the time to stop. I don't know if the court has it. We certainly rely on the other issues that we've raised as well, in terms of the objective materiality on summary judgment. And I would point out there that we did have an affidavit from Mr. Southworth that the amenities were essentially the same before or after Ritz left. There's no change in the value of the lot due to Ritz's withdrawal. And on summary judgment, it's just a court can't reasonably say that it was objectively material where the amenities are the same. There's no change in the value due to this, so we would respectfully.
Let me just ask you one question on this issue 100 of the exemption here. There was an opinion letter about this issue, was there not?
Given? That's correct, Your Honor.
And that's at page 57 of the joint appendix. And
yes, sir.
It indicates that the opinion letter of the attorney was once the developer had sold 65 lots, he thought it would then qualify.
That's correct.
For that, but. You never sold anywhere near 65, did you?
Not as of yet, Your Honor.
Was an option to seek an advisory opinion, and your client elected not to do that, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Folk. Thank you. You reserve time. Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chap Peterson on behalf of the Appalese, Keith and Courtney Nahegan. I just
to first address what Justice Gergel had said about Section 1709, and I have it right in front of me. The court may order damages, specific performance, or such other relief as the court deems fair, just, and equitable. And this is really the catch-all provision as to violations and liabilities under what I'm going to call ILSA. And that is what Judge Koutouras relied on. Now, I want to go back and actually...
What does that do to the specific revocation rescission provision?
Well, it's ironic, Judge, in that 1703C talks about a specific revocation provision where there has been that contractual disclaimer made that you have the two-year out clause. And I'll just read it. 1703C, in any case of or any contract for the sale or lease of a lot...
Well, we know. Okay. What is that?
Well, let me just read this portion. Such contract may be revoked at the option of the purchaser within 2 years from the date of such signing, and such contract or agreement shall clearly provide that right. Now, this agreement didn't provide that right. One of the ironies in this case was we sued for rescission in Loudoun County Circuit Court and State Court in May of 2009 within that two-year window. Of course, the sales contract we sued on didn't state the language in 17.
But it doesn't say you have a two-year right if it states it. It says you have that.
It just says at your option.
I'm going to say, even if the contract doesn't say it, don't you think you would still have that two-year right?
Yes, sir, I do, which is why I've always contended. And, again, I'm here to support Judge Koutouras' opinion. I still believe we were an automatic revocation case, even though it wasn't in our contract, because we filed within 2 years for rescission. Again, without any knowledge that we had this contractual right or the statutory right, we filed within 2 years. Now, I know my colleague
but
on the other
side. You still haven't answered to me how you think it's consistent. How is the general damages provision consistent with this?
I think what this is, again, this speaks specifically to 1703C, and it says that if you don't provide the property report, one of the remedies.
I know all that.
Yes, sir.
I know all that. Don't you think that.
I think they are consistent. I think that's
just. Let me finish my question.
Yes, sir. I'm sorry.
Don't you think the facts under 1703C attain in your case, you think you would be entitled to use 1703C?
Yes,
correct?
Sir. And we sued under 1703C.
I didn't ask you that. So I'm now asking you, though, how do you see that 1703C,
yep,
dealing with rescission, is consistent with rescission being available under the general provision?
Well, 1703C is an automatic, as the court has previously pointed out.
Where is it? Does it say automatic?
Well, it says it may be revoked at the option of the purchaser. I would take option to mean that's an option. If you have a good reason, a bad reason, or an indifferent reason, you can revoke. You don't need to.
You think that option means automatic?
If it's exercised by the purchaser, yes, sir. In other words, if the purchaser qualifies under 1703C, they can automatically revoke a contract which qualifies under this provision. In other words, it's the flip side of equitable. And I understand we're here as an equitable rescission case per Judge Koutouras's, but I think we've obviously spent a lot of time briefing that distinction. 1703C, as previously said by Judge Ellis and Judge Koutouras and all the opinions they've written, that's an automatic revocation. We're here as an equitable rescission. I believe we're that sort of weird case. We qualify under either because my clients did file suit timely in Loudoun County Circuit Court.
It seems to suggest that on one hand, if you have the mercy of the general one, the court may or may not grant equitable relief for those other things. But as to this provision, you're required.
I don't think the court has a choice. And I think, frankly, I don't think the developer has a choice. And remember, this only kicks in, Your Honor, if they don't provide the property. If they provide the property report, we have nothing to talk about. If they don't provide a property report, if it's too much trouble or they don't want to collect the information or they just don't want to do it, then they need to put that provision in the sales contract. They didn't do either, and that's what brings us.
What about the 100-unit exception,
Your Honor?
That's his second argument.
I obviously we spent a lot of time on that on the trial court level. Any time that they can say it's our intent to hold lots aside and it's our intent to sell certain lots to developers,
why can't they do that? In your opinion?
Well, first of all,
not just your opinion, but under the law and the facts, why can't they do that?
I think that the holdings are pretty clear, and I note the one case that sort of supported this provision that until you build a certain number of lots, you don't qualify was the Bodansky case out of New York, and that has since been reversed. So I believe that once you start marketing 100-plus lots in a common promotional scheme, you fit in to the law, and then it becomes your burden to show that you're exempted. And I think for you to merely say, oh, it's our intent, Well, that the law specifically speaks to the present tense, that if you are marketing 100-plus lots in a common promotional scheme, then you qualify. And
I don't think that's correct. I don't think that it's so clear under the regulations. You think that's clear under the regulations? Then why would the regulation have a provision that talks about, you know, no matter what you did, if you go beyond those sales, then you would then be subjected to the process?
Your Honor, I'm confused. When you say regulation, I'm talking about the law itself. I understand that the HUD regulations, and I dispute, by the way.
They're actually not HUD regulations. They're HUD guidelines.
HUD guidelines, exactly. I mean, they're on the Internet. And even those HUD guidelines, if you read them in full, talk about an action being taken. They have to be, quote, reserved. And reserved means you actually had to go out and say, okay, this lot, and this
Who
lot.
Who says that? Who says reserved has to mean that?
Well, as someone using the English language, when the HUD guidelines, again, guidelines, say reserved. And I believe if you look at them, I don't have them in front of me, and I'm going to rely on the briefing.
No, you just said reserved on the guidelines now that you want to say means something. You say reserved, because
yeah.
You have to say this lot. It doesn't say that. What does it say anything like that?
Well, no.
But you have to point out a specific lot. In fact, it says just
Your
the
Honor,
opposite of that.
I'm not saying it says you have to point out a specific lot. What I'm saying is what by using the word reserved in the past tense,
right.
It's an action being taken. An action has been taken. It's not enough to simply say.
Well, that's why they say they've done that.
Well, Your Honor, they have. I mean, it's undisputed. My clients went out there and they said you can have any one of these 164 lots.
It doesn't say you have to reserve specific lots.
Well, Your Honor, if that's the case, then they can simply say, well, we have 164 lots we're marketing and we're going to sell them all. And once we get into the 90s, we're just simply going to, if we get sued, we can simply say, oh, well, the other 65 are held aside for builders. There's no actual evidence of that.
What in the law says they can't do that?
Well,
I know you don't want them to be able to do that.
Your Honor,
the law says they can't do that.
I have to fall back on what Judge Gutierrez says, which the law speaks to the present tense. And it talks about, again, that they would have, they market in a common promotional scheme that. It's not enough for them to simply say, well, we have the intent at a future date to sell certain lots to builders.
So, in other words, you can't point to the law. You're just saying somebody else said it. You can't point me to anything in the law that says that. You can't. I'm just asking you. Well, you may be right, but what about the law? Not what somebody thinks should be, not somebody thinks what the result ought to be. What in the law says that?
Your Honor, I guess what I'd have to do is if I could go back and look at Judge Gutierrez's opinion, because I know he spoke specifically
to that. Well, you haven't looked at the law in preparation for this?
Your Honor, I'm looking right at... I'm looking right at the statute itself.
It's not intended as a trap question. I'm just asking what says you're saying the law doesn't say what they say. I'm asking they're saying the law doesn't say what you say. I'm asking you what in the law says what you say it says, that it says that.
Well,
look at those guidelines, the guidelines, for whatever weight you give them, they anticipate, can certainly be read to anticipate a situation where a builder just reserve, not specific lot, but reserves a number.
Your Honor, I guess my fundamental, I disagree that the guidelines say what you first of all, I disagree that the guidelines are either controlling. I disagree with that. But secondly,
do you think they give any guidance whatsoever if there's a question about what the act means?
I'm not even prepared to concede that again.
So in other words, is it your position we shouldn't even look at them?
Your Honor, you could look at them. Again, I think they're outweighed by the clear language of the statute, which talks about what you have to do.
But I'm asking you about what weight do you think we should give or can give to the guidelines? Zero or more than zero?
Zero.
Okay.
Mr. Speaker, let me ask you this question. I can't seem to lay hands on the guidelines myself right now, but is my memory correct that even under the guidelines for the exemption for the builder, the builder had to construct within 2 years.
Your Honor, I believe that's correct, and I have to go back and look at them. But again, and my point was, Judge Shedd, that there's a specific action that has to be taken by the builder. It's not just enough to express an intent.
I understand that. So where does that come from?
In the guidelines themselves.
In the guidelines?
In the guidelines themselves, it talks about an action being taken. And again, I know I just said the guidelines are meaningless, and now I'm referring back to them. But to the extent you want to put meaning into them, I'm just saying I'm going to look right at them.
Is there any evidence that builders had committed to build on those lots within 2 years?
No.
Actually, there's no evidence.
In fact, ironically, and this was part of the record, when they moved for summary judgment, part of the affidavit was we looked on the Internet, and they were still marketing the whole number of lots on the Internet. There never was a distinction made in their marketing or to my client. Your Honor, I just have a few minutes left. You haven't asked me about the issue of prejudgment interest, which was significant. We were denied prejudgment interest on the $1.5 million that was financed. I know
that. Why would you be entitled to that under rescission?
Well, because we've been paying prejudgment. We've been paying interest on that.
You had the property, didn't you?
Yes, but the property has been undeveloped, and we've had to pay the carrying costs on it.
That's the luck of the draw. In the rescission, you put the parties in the status quo ante.
Your Honor, I would say that in a situation like this where it's undisputed my client never used the property, he had to pay taxes and insurance on the property.
Did he have the property? Was it deeded to him?
It was deeded to him.
So he owned the property?
Yes, he did.
So it wasn't the money in exchange for the property under the original contract?
Your Honor, I'm saying that the property was exchanged. I'm also saying that the point of the rescission was to take the parties back to 2000.
Original position, which was they get the property back, you get your money back.
During the interim of the hold, the defendant held the money, had the use of the plaintiff's money?
They had the use of our money, and they also had the ability to avoid paying taxes on it, insurance on it, as well as, of course, we had to pay the note on it.
A recognition of that very fact that the defendant is holding the money at the time and has its use, and prejudgment interest is to restore the plaintiff to that view because he
yes,
not that's, the money.
Yes, that's our position.
But,
now,
you had the ownership of the property in the meantime, too. Ownership of property is worth something, too, isn't it?
Not in this case, Your
Honor.
Oh, right.
No. Fair market value, mate. That's different than fair market value. The ownership of property is worth something. Maybe it's nothing more than just the fact that you're a homeowner. But you are entitled to go back to where you were in the first instance. If in fact, as you had gone out and used that, I'm not saying you did,
yes,
but
sir.
Used that property to picnic on and maybe to use it for a boat launch into a lake or something, you would then have to pay them for that recreational use?
No, we would not have, Your Honor. Again, this is...
Why, under your theory, why wouldn't you have to? That would at least be an offset, wouldn't it? Because that's something you gain from the contract.
Well, if that's the case, I simply say that you have a piece of undeveloped land. There's no dispute it's undeveloped. We've paid all the costs on it for the past 4 years and are continuing to pay all the costs on it. This was to take the parties back to where they were in 2007. And I didn't understand why the judge made the distinction that he made, because in your position, we wouldn't be entitled to any prejudgment interest. As it was, we got it on 12% of the purchase cost.
Yeah. Has the rest been appealed? That there should be no prejudgment interest?
No, there's no appeal. The only appeal on that is my appeal.
So they're willing to take the 12%?
I suppose.
They haven't appealed.
Judge, I have 2 minutes left, so I'm going to reserve the rest of the time.
Thank you. Mr. Polk, you back up?
Yes, sir. Thank you. First, I'd like to address a couple points Judge Gergel had asked about. First was the question about the HUD, what are called guidelines. In fact, they are interpretive rules of HUD that were published in the Federal Register first on September 23, 1983, and I would refer you to page 7 of our opening brief. Not only are they interpretive rules that have been published and republished in the Federal Register since 1983, but they actually were published as part of notice and comment. Even though under the Administrative Procedure Act, you don't have to use notice and comment rulemaking for interpretive rules. In this instance, they were published as part of notice and comment in 1983. And under this court's precedent, they are clearly entitled to deference. They certainly are not to be
ignored. But to the extent
ignored.
They're inconsistent with the statute trumps, correct?
I would agree if they were inconsistent with the statute would trump. However, the problem with the Nahigian's position and also with Judge Kacharis' position is that it completely ignores the Dictionary Act at 1 U.S.C. Section 1, which the people at HUD who drafted the interpretive rules obviously had in mind when they came up with the specific language.
What about this
language
with the builder? The builder had to do it within 2 years, building within 2 years. Is there any evidence in the record to support they met even the guideline requirement of having of the builders meeting the 2-year requirement?
I'm glad you asked that question, Your Honor, because you're referring to the exemption, a different exemption than the one that we claim, and that's the exemption that was also the subject of the Long case decided by the Fourth Circuit, and that is actually an exemption at 15 U.S.C. 1702. to...
Well, Nickel versus Beauview of Biloxi, Fifth Circuit, 2011, makes reference in terms of this issue.
It does make not to this exemption. The exemption they were referring to is the same one under, which is Long, which is a different exemption.
Are you asserting that there is no two-year build-out rule under the 100-lot exemption?
That's correct, Your Honor, because basically if you look at 1702A2 is what Judge Gergel was asking about, and that's not the exemption we're talking about. That's okay. The one that has the two-year limit in. If you look at 1702A7, that's the exemption we're talking about, which is the sales to builders. And under both the Long decision by this court and under the interpretive rules, you first look at 1702A7, okay, and you exclude anything that involves sales to builders.
Let me ask you this.
Yes, sir.
If there is a two-year build-out requirement or two-year requirement under the exemption you're claiming, then you would not qualify for that exemption.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, but we're not claiming that exemption.
I didn't ask you
yes.
that.
Yes, sir.
So if there is such an exemption, then a two-year build-out requirement, then you cannot claim the exemption you would like to. That's your position. If there is.
Yes, sir.
All right, but you're asserting that in this, that there is no such two-year requirement under this exemption.
Yes, sir.
But why do you fall under this exemption? I've left aside right. Now the two-year issue.
Yes, sir.
The facts will be what they are on that.
Yes, sir.
Law. But why do you qualify here?
Okay, 1702A7 is the sale or lease of lots to any person who acquires such lots.
Don't read it. Just tell me. Why is it
that's
so?
That's sales to builders. It doesn't have any requirement, two-year requirement at all.
You heard the talk about reserved lots?
Yes, sir.
And there's a suggestion that you somehow have to do something more than indicate you intend to reserve them.
Right.
What about that?
That's incorrect, Your Honor, because if you look at the interpretive rule and you look particularly on page 17 of our opening brief or if you on the electronic...
Just answer it. Don't tell me where to look. Just tell me what your answer is. The answer is what? All you have to do is announce that you plan to reserve them? Or just to have that in your mind? Or what's required to reserve to get you within that exemption?
You have to reserve means to hold back is the dictionary definition. It's not defined under ILSA. It's not defined under the interpretive
rule. What must you do? More, what would prevent any developer to be exempt from the act by saying it's my intent not to sell, not to be more than 99 units? Is that enough just to say I have it in my mind? And though you're out offering it as a common plan, there's a statutory presumption it's common. You're offering all the lots to anyone who wants them. As long as you have it in your head, that's enough to get an exemption?
That's an issue of proof, Your Honor, if it's reserved or not.
What's the evidence of the proof other than they said that was in my mind?
They could say that. I think that would be pretty tough to prove.
It would be tough to prove at all. You would just do an affidavit and say that's what I intended from the start. Not tough to prove.
But in this case, Your Honor, you do have something that precedes the subdivision where it's clearly intended, and there were actions taken in furtherance of that, including the agreements with
the builders. What would happen if you had that intent? And I think you may be right. Maybe you can just do that. Yes, what happens if you violate the rule, even though you had that? You started with that intent,
yes, sir.
But you then violate the rule. What happens?
Well, Your Honor, that's a good question, too, because you measure the exemption at the time the contract signed. However, if you later, your position, you would be one subject to a claim under there is a statute of limitation.
Let me ask you, what does this mean? You seem to have trouble answering directly what I'm asking.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
But this says at the end of that guideline, regulation, whatever it is, the sale of more than 99 lots in transactions not exempt would nullify this exemption for prior and future sales and might result in prior sales being voidable at the purchaser's option. So then it might well make those sales that were made at the time you said you had the intent, and therefore you didn't have to give property information, it might make you violate that section as to prior sales if you do sell more than 100 lots. Isn't that correct?
I disagree, Your Honor, because okay. you measure it at the time of the signing of the contract.
What does it say would nullify this exemption for prior sales. What does that mean to you?
I'm sorry, where are you reading that from?
I'm reading from the last of the 100-lot exemption. It's the third paragraph, 1, 2, 3. You see the paragraph that says developers of subdivisions containing more than 99 lots?
Okay.
Look at that. See, I'll read it to you.
But you're not, I'm sorry.
You see, it starts with developers of subdivisions?
No, sir, I'm looking at 17, I'm looking at the statute, 15
no,
U.S.C.
I'm looking at the regulations.
Okay, you're looking at
the regulations.
24 CFR, Your Honor?
It's hard to take time, but could I have him answer
please,
this question?
Please.
Yeah, do you have that in front of you or not?
I don't have
let
the 24
me read
CFR.
It to you. Let me read it to you. The third paragraph of the 100-lot exemption in the regulations, as I think that's what I'm holding here,
yes,
reads
sir.
This way. Developers of subdivisions containing more than 99 lots who wish to operate under this exemption must assure themselves that all lots in excess of 99 have been and will be sold in transactions exempt under 24 CFR 1710.5 B through H. The sale of more than 99 lots in transactions not exempt under 1710.5 B through H would nullify this exemption for prior and future sales and might result in prior sales being voidable at the purchaser's option.
Yes, sir.
If so that, doesn't that suggest that it's not just measured from the time the contract is signed, but it's prior sales?
I would agree. If that's what you've read the regulation to me, and that's what it says.
I'll vouch to you.
Yes, sir. I'm not saying that you wouldn't.
But what I'm saying, that indicates, doesn't that indicate then that you can have this concept of reserved, and it's more
yes,
loose
sir.
Than maybe some would want to say, but then you stand in at risk for, you said not prior sales, but I think that regulation suggests prior sales, doesn't it?
Yes, sir. That does say that, and I apologize if I misunderstood okay. before.
Have you seen that provision before?
I probably have at some point, but not recently.
May I ask one more question?
No, please.
If, in fact, that's true,
yes, sir.
That the prior sales can be called into question. What does that do to the two-year limitation in 1703C?
Well, Your Honor, I think...
You know what we refer to as the automatic?
Yes, sir.
I don't know that it's automatic.
Right.
But it's something specific. What would the fact that a builder does something in the future, maybe several years in the future...
Yes, sir.
What would it do to that 1703C as far as revocation for a prior purchaser?
Your Honor, I would submit that the analysis would be that you would proceed under the statute of limitation under 1709 and the statute of limitations at 1711B, which in the case of discovery, it's not a, in other words, it doesn't date from the date of signing, but it dates from the date of discovery.
Although that provision specifically says in 1703 that it is from the date the contract signed, doesn't it say that?
It does, sir. It does, Your Honor.
So you just think then that, let me ask you this much, you think then under some circumstances envisioned by the Act and the guidelines, a general provision can override this specific provision of 1703C?
No, sir. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is your claim wouldn't be under 1703C. Your claim would be essentially would amount to fraud under 1711.
But it's not fraud. Mm-hmm. It's not fraud. They just changed their mind. So there's no fraud involved, but let me pursue this just a
yes,
little
sir.
Bit more on the time. But now, you need to be careful how you answer this question, but I think it's interesting to me to know how you answer it.
Yes, sir.
There's a suggestion that 1703C cannot be overridden by a general provision. But so I'm asking you now, if you look at a person, in 1703C, the revocation provision says, within 2 years from the date of such signing. That means the signing of the contract by that party, doesn't it?
By the purchaser, that's correct. Your
that's right.
Yes, sir.
Well, that date could have expired before the Act even applied as to a specific purchaser under the regulations.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So then, tell me again, then does 1703C, does that no longer, it just doesn't apply?
It would be a different claim.
I'm going to ask you that. Does 1703C, does the purchaser, who would normally be entitled to that two-year so-called automatic revocation, is that just out of the window because of the actions of the builder, the developer?
I believe that's the correct reading of the statute, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you. Did you object to this on the basis of lack of ripeness?
I'm sorry?
Did you argue that case wasn't ripe?
The case wasn't? No, sir. That would essentially be Bedansky the district court decision in Budansky, and I don't. Actually, Ritz-Carlton did make that argument below on summary judgment based on Budansky. Well, we joined in on the motion, but
you didn't make it here.
We haven't essentially made it
because it almost was the provision that Judge Shedd read is part of this with the contract. You could argue that well until you get that because your remedy will come later on because once you build that one too many, then you'll go back to everyone you sold it to and they had the option to say, I want revocation.
I guess the way I would frame it, Your Honor, is that there's no cause of action now because we're exempt under the HUD guidelines, which are consistent with the statute.
Can I ask one further question?
Go ahead. Sure.
Why do you not challenge all interest, prejudgment interest?
Well, Your Honor,
under what theory do you not challenge all prejudgment interest?
Well, Your Honor, we could have, but there is a line of Fourth Circuit. The part was practicality. We had raised five issues on appeal.
So the answer is why?
There is a line of Fourth Circuit cases that allows the on the issue of the amount of interest, which we would have been the prevailing party as to the what their cross appeal is below, that the party opposing this, which would be us on the interest, they can rely on any theory, argument, or contention that's supported by the record, even though it was specifically rejected by the lower court. And there's a line of cases going Nivens versus Gilchrist.
So you argue against any prejudgment interest being paid to them?
No, sir, because we didn't specifically appeal as to any prejudgment interest, but what we did do is we oppose additional interest,
well,
and
I'm asking you, what's your theory on that they're entitled to some and not all?
Well, the theory, Your Honor, is first, the district court wouldn't have to give them any interest at all, and we can rely under these line of cases in the Fourth Circuit, we can rely on that theory in opposing their cross appeal, even though we didn't appeal the awarding of the amount of interest.
I'm saying, I don't know if I understand what all you're saying.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
But it could be me. I'm just asking, are you opposing any prejudgment interest being paid, or just some being paid?
Your Honor, certainly we don't think any prejudgment interest was appropriate,
but
we didn't raise that as a specific issue on appeal.
Are you objecting to the 12% that was paid or whatever that was paid? Are you objecting to that?
Your Honor.
The answer would be yes or no. The amount of interest that was awarded by the judge, are you objecting to that in this appeal, prejudgment interest? You know better than I do, bro.
I would say yes if I have to give a yes or no. I would give an explanation if I could.
Is that a difficult answer?
Given the procedural posture we're in, it is, and I don't mean to be difficult, but I would say if pushed to say yes or no, I'd say yes.
Okay, I'll take it because
yes,
I pushed you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Folk.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Peterson, you have reserved some time.
Cut that to about 30 seconds.
I thought you were going to say, based on the prior, you got plenty of time.
Your Honor, I get the feeling the justices know this case law very, very well. All I'm going to point out is just the Budansky case, which does go to Judge Shedd's questions, that it talks about whether a lot is exempt under the 100-lot exemption is determined as of the time a purchaser or lessee signs a contract to purchase or lease that lot. So, I think Budansky specifically addressed this issue, so you don't have to unwind all these transactions.
No, but what about that regulation? That regulation suggests that, in fact, something that was at one point exempt is not exempt now.
Your Honor, all I can say is the regulation was not voted on by members of Congress. It's not a United States law.
So wait a minute now. Well, I kind of like that theory that regulations mean nothing in the world, but I don't believe that carries a day in any court I've ever heard of.
Your Honor, in another capacity, I pass laws, and I know what's a law
and
what's a regulation.
Just let me say this much. You absolutely are not standing here suggesting that regulations carry no weight on federal law. I wouldn't be opposed to that necessarily, but that's not the law. That's not the law, is it?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that they are entitled to some minimum deference, but when they conflict with the plain words...
I didn't say that, and that's not what you said either. But I'm just asking this. It seems to me that regulation flies in the face of the argument that once exempt, always exempt. Do you?
I would agree with you, Your Honor, if it's interpreted the way that the other side has said you could spin it out
literally into ad nauseum, particularly since these lots are still being marketed today, that these claims could come back and forth.
Let me ask you this much.
Yes, sir.
You seem to be mixing up the facts of this case with the general principle I'm trying to find from the regulation. Don't you think that regulation clearly stands? Can you envision in a hypothetical, I know you say it's not this case, where a developer has properly reserved lots to fall within that 100-lot exemption? Could you envision that?
I could see a situation where a developer would seal off.
And can you envision that?
Yes.
All right. If you take that provision that you have now accepted, could you see that down the road the developer could violate that plan?
Yes.
So at least you acknowledge that situation could happen.
I acknowledge that that could.
And then I'm suggesting to you that this regulation, at least the way I read it, suggests that in violating his initial plan, the developer subjects himself to some kind of liability under the Act that did not exist when the contract was signed. You don't agree with that?
I would agree with that.
I thought you would. So why are you fighting that regulation so hard?
Your Honor, that's why I didn't want to speak. I'm not fighting you. I'm not fighting you at all.
Just let me point out to you. But you start off by saying regulations aren't law or something like that. That's what you got up and said.
Your Honor, I'm trying to defend an opinion which said that the regulation was superseded by United States law. I'm here to defend that opinion.
I understand that.
So that's what I'm doing.
Doesn't mean you can't answer the questions that I ask you.
Yes, sir.
I don't understand your hostility toward that regulation. I can understand you say that regulation may not apply in this case, but I don't understand your hostility, which appears to be your hostility, to my question about doesn't this create the pot? This regulation, to me, in large measure, is pro-purchaser. It's not pro-builder in large measure, because it can create a right in a prior purchaser that didn't exist at the time. Do you understand the import of that question?
Yes, Your Honor, I understand. I guess, and I know you don't want me to cite the statute, but I keep coming back to what 1702A7 says, which is, the provisions of this chapter, this is the exemptions, shall not apply to the sale or lease of lots to any person who acquires such lots for the purposes of essentially building houses. So, I mean, again, it's in the present tense, and I understand that the regulation perhaps expands upon that and elaborates upon that, but I'm just looking at the plain language of the statute, and that's my only point, Your Honor. That's all I have.
All right. Thank you very much. We're going to come down and greet counsel, then proceed to our last case for today.